It was right about a year ago today that I stepped into this building for the first time to interview to see if we would be a good match to be the interim minister at the time. And amongst the many questions I was asked was some variation on what my theology was. Because in Unitarian Universalist circles, it's not enough just to be a Unitarian Universalist. It's like being ice cream. You have to be a particular flavor as well as being ice cream. And what that really means is you're usually divided in, there's Unitarian Universalist Christians, and there are Unitarian Universalist congregations, mostly in New England, that are really pretty Christian in their orientation, not too much different from congregational churches. Some Unitarian Universalists have a strong identification with Judaism or with Buddhism. Some are secular humanists and so forth. And basically, congregations want to know what their minister is likely to say when he or she is up here. Is it going to be largely out of a Christian context or humanist or whatever? And I said, I am a transcendentalist. Now that one, that happens to be true, but also I think it's the best answer you can give because most Unitarian Universalists don't really know what a transcendentalist is. But they know that it's good. And this is even a better answer than it would have been at most places, because little did I know that this congregation, perhaps uniquely amongst Unitarian Universalist congregations, was founded by transcendentalists. So I stumbled into even a righter answer than I knew. So, what is a transcendentalist? Well, it's frankly a little elusive, even if you know something about it. It's a rebellion from a rebellion from a rebellion from a rebellion. That is to say, the Church of England rebelled against Catholicism, Puritanism rebelled against the Church of England, Unitarianism rebelled against Puritanism, and Transcendentalism rebelled against Unitarianism. So here we are. The Unitarians rebelled against Puritanism in New England in the 18th century, primarily by being those ministers who wished to use reason to bear on their faith and interpretation of the scriptures, as well as revelation. Most of the ministers and congregants in New England at the time would be what we would now call fundamentalists, who believed in the literal transmission of the Bible and so forth. And there were some ministers who thought that things like the miracle of Jesus walking on water and so forth might better be understood metaphorically rather than literally. Since these ministers were therefore claiming less than ultimate and complete divinity for Jesus Christ, they were called heretics, Unitarians. And after a couple of decades of being accused of being Unitarians, they admitted that they were guilty as charged. And the American Unitarian Association was founded in 1825, but not as a collection of congregations, as the Unitarian Universalist Association is today, but as a collection of individuals. Those Unitarians from the various parish churches in New England banded together. Now, this was successful, and shortly thereafter, most of the old first parishes in New England had become Unitarian churches. Now, one of the next generation of people to grow up in that Unitarian churches was a man whose father and uncle had been Unitarian ministers, a man named Ralph Waldo Emerson. And Emerson spent a couple of years in the Unitarian parish ministry, which he hated. And he gave an address in 1838, which is a landmark address. It's called Emerson's Divinity School Address, and if you're studying for the UU ministry, you have to read it. And I actually recommend it to you, like so many things, you can find it online now. He had one deathless phrase, dry as dust Unitarianism. Because he thought that the original generation of Unitarians in uplifting reason on a par with revelation in interpreting scripture had raised up reason exclusively to the extent of any other kind of response, and they became distant and objective and not much fun. And that tradition of not much fun in New England Unitarianism has existed down to this day. The elements of transcendentalism are many. Nature and emotion and spirit, as well as reason, coming to bear on your spiritual development. Revelation especially as found in nature. Really, transcendentalism is an American romantic movement. The same kind of movement that was Delacroix in painting and Coleridge and Wordsworth and Blake in poetry. It was that expression in a wide range of intellectual pursuits in the United States. As you may know, that the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge was a Unitarian minister. And one time he said to one of his friends, "You know, I don't believe you've ever heard me preach." And the response was, "My dear Coleridge, I don't think I've ever heard you do anything but." Another fundamental aspect of transcendentalism is suspicion of institutions, especially churches. Because the primacy of the individual development in perhaps the single most famous essay in American history, Self-Reliance by Emerson. It all comes out of that self-reliance. You're on your own. Your own development is primacy, and there should not be anything shackling that individual development. And churches, of course, were prime suspects in the shackling of that transcendentalist spirit. Another aspect that goes right along with this was knowledge of Eastern religions. Emerson was one of the first American intellectuals to really study the Bhagavad Gita and Buddhist text. Some of his most famous essays are really American expressions of Eastern religious concepts. Oversoul is basically the Hindu concept of Brahma, that overarching reality that is in us and transcends us all. Compensation. His essay on compensation is basically the laws of karma. What comes around goes around. You will reap what you sow. Transcendentalism was one of the first, probably the first movement in America that championed the rights of women, the rights of prisoners, and the rights of slaves. And as a matter of fact, as we see, the transcendentalist movement became also annealed to the abolitionist movement. There's a famous example where Thoreau is imprisoned for failing to pay his tax to support the Mexican War. As you may know, the Mexican War was basically fought in order to keep Texas safe for slavery. Emerson went to visit him, and he said, "Why are you in prison?" And Thoreau said, as I'm sure you know, "Why are you not in prison?" That's a great example of transcendentalism approach to equality and justice. There was also the experiment of Brook Farm, a commune where people would live according to freedom and the principles of transcendentalism. Unfortunately, the people who did this were mostly well-educated intellectuals, and they could have used some blacksmiths and farmers and weavers and so forth, and it didn't last very long, but it was a good experiment. And one of the guys who was at Brook Farm, he was at Brook Farm when he was 18 and 19, is George Curtis, whose picture is on our in our library, because he was one of our most prominent members for many years. Where can you imagine growing up at Brook Farm when you're 18 and 19 with those kinds of values? And he brought them into this congregation. And that brings me to this congregation almost. Because there was one Unitarian minister who was clearly a transcendentalist. And that was Theodore Parker. And he wrote a famous sermon called on the permanent and transient in Christianity. And it's the one transcendentalist sermon about Unitarianism. It's really good. It holds up really well today. He says, in Christianity, people are burned at the stake for affirming in one generation, but people are burned at the stake for denying in another generation. And that the doctrines of Christianity and the institutions of Christianity is what is transient. What is permanent is the spirit and the approach to life of Jesus' words and sermons. And he was really, if not the first really public transcendentalist abolitionist. As I said different times, he kept a pistol in his drawer of his office because he was part of the Underground Railroad. He confronted slave owners. He failed to obey Dred Scott, the Fugitive Slave Law. And he was forbidden from preaching in almost every other Unitarian pulpit of its time. Now, Margaret Fuller died in 1850, and Emerson thought that the Transcendentalist movement was over. He was wrong, because there was a new generation who had grown up with the example of Theodore Parker and Margaret Fuller. People like George Curtis and Francis George Shaw, who came here to so his wife could get help with her eyes. There was a very famous and effective eye doctor in Staten Island. And he came here, and she was cured, and he stayed here. And he was one of, not only a rich man, he was one of the richest men in America. Basically, his father invented the China trade for the United States. And I'll be preaching about him specifically on Father's Day. But he was a member of Theodore Parker's church in West Roxbury before he moved here. And so he and a numbers of others that formed these churches, and I realize this is why this is not the first Unitarian Church of Staten Island, because it's not the first Unitarian Church of Staten Island. There were two similar churches that were sort of Unitarian, and then they got together. So we're clearly the, but it's unclear whether we're the first. And Randy's saying yes, because he's the one that gave me all this information, and I really appreciate this. So when we were formed primarily by these transcendentalist, abolitionist, rich guys who could, frankly, afford to be transcendentalists and abolitionists because it wasn't a very popular thing to be. But part of their values were still, what? Suspicion of churches and clergy. These chandeliers come from the building that was here before and go back to a long time. When those chandeliers were installed next door, they could have easily been made of gold. There was a lot of money in the pockets of the people who form this church. And they gave not a lot of their money to the church, but they gave a lot of the church's money. Get it? And that's how we were started. A very wealthy people who had what we consider very progressive values, not very often found in the same package. And so the foundation of this congregation is, I think it's unique within Unitarian Universalist circles. And it makes our approach to who we are, even today, again, quite unique. It's unusual because we've inherited a lot of those transcendentalist values. Equality for women and prisoners' rights and appreciation of nature and suspicion of clergy and weak churches. And part of what I'm about here is to maintain some of those values and transform others. Now, in fact, most Unitarian Universalist congregations today are guided by these transcendentalist values in many ways. And that's, I think, nobody would be more surprised than Margaret Fuller and Emerson than to know that their values have been institutionalized by the church that rejected them so thoroughly when they were alive. It's a funny thing the way things work out. As Emerson would say, well, this is compensation. But it doesn't mean we have everything figured out. As a matter of fact, it's a fundamental value of transcendentalists that we don't think we have everything figured out. We got to keep looking. We got to keep searching. We got to keep sitting under that tree. But the particular things that we don't have figured out are, again, rather unique to a transcendentalist institution. And as I've said in other ways, it basically comes down to a conflict between two of Emerson's essays, Self-Reliance and The Oversoul. The importance of the individual personal development and that person existing in a community and a vast reality far beyond that individual. And sometimes those things come into conflict, and sometimes they work together. Sometimes you can call it a struggle, or a contention, or grappling, or a battle, or an engagement, or a process. But there is a hymn in our hymnal written by Rick Maston who said, "Let it be a dance." And that, I think, is really the ultimate way that transcendentalists in all days need to approach the struggle that they have with their own development. Whether it's being a better person, being part of a better society, or understanding more completely where they fit in a fathomless and unknowable universe. We welcome the new members today to this beloved community, and to enter into this beloved process, this struggle of life and love. Let it be a dance. May we join together in our closing hymn. Is that right? Or did I mess something up again? Is that what we do? Yes. Hymn number 360, Here We Have Gathered.